the worst earthquake in Taiwan in 25 years.
9 people have died and more than 900 people have been injured.
NATO at 75.
This was the great fire in the city of London. Pictures that look like hell on earth.
And what time is it on the moon?
It's 5:24 p.m. Central Time, but know that there is some give and take.
It comes as no surprise that moon time differs from Earth time.
Today is Thursday, April 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. It was the biggest earthquake to hit Taiwan in 25 years. 9 people were killed and more than 900 were injured. On Thursday, the demolition of buildings heavily damaged and uninhabitable began, some of them tilted at precarious angles. The quake, a magnitude 7.2, triggered massive landslides and a small tsunami on the southern Japanese islands. There have been more than 50 aftershocks since the original tremor.
Let's get the latest now. Joining us from Taiwan is VOA's William Yang. So tell us what the latest is today.
So the latest situation is that the rescue efforts are continuing because there are still more than 100 people trapped in different parts of Hualien, which is the epic center of the earthquake. And at the same time, the authorities are also putting a lot of resources into reopening some of the main transportation routes into the area because most of the main transportation routes have suffered serious damage yesterday during the earthquake. So in order to let the resources going in and also allowing people to travel out of that area to receive whatever support that they need, this is one of the priorities for the authorities as well.
We've seen a lot of the pictures of the buildings which are tilted out of whack. And I understand that demolition has started because they're just unsafe to walk near or be in. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So because I think at least 43 or probably now more buildings are partially collapsed, not completely. So just like you pointed out, the authorities are also trying to make sure that they are not imposing any danger to the people in Hualien. And they are trying to make the best out of the time that they have to start the demolition. Also because over the next few days, the weather in that area is actually not going to be too great. There are torrential rains being expected in the area. And so that's also one of the things that they need to do on top of all the evacuation and the clearing out the transportation routes efforts.
With more than 900 people injured, hospitals overcrowded, what are they doing with all of the injured?
So they are triaging some of the more seriously injured people to nearby hospitals in neighboring counties because the capacity of the hospitals within Hualien County obviously is already overcrowded, and they're also concerned about the lack of medical supplies. And if that's the case, and with the traffic into the area still not back to the normal capacity, they need to ration the amount of the supply that they have. So some of the more seriously injured people have already been gradually airlifted to nearby areas to receive treatment.
And for survivors who either lost their home or are still in their homes, food, water, other daily necessities?
Right. So most of the people living in buildings that have suffered serious damage have been transported to nearby community centers. And this is one of the national protocol that Taiwan has already had in place for the last few decades. And usually once they arrive at the community center, all the food and all the basic supplies and needs will be taken care of, and all the materials and resources will be provided by the local government, and the central authorities have also already worked with the local authorities to make sure that resources that are necessary will be able to reach people in the area as soon as they can.
William, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
William Yang, VOA's William Yang in Taiwan.
Over the past week, there have been massive protests in Israel during which many Israelis called for new elections, unhappy with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Wednesday, a member of Netanyahu's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, called for national elections in September.
I believe that the Israeli society needs to renew its contract with its leadership, and I think the only way to do it and still maintaining the national effort in fighting Hamas and terrorist group and other security challenges is by having an agreed election date that we have to discuss when and if.
More reaction from the deaths of aid workers in an Israeli airstrike late Monday. Celebrity chef Jose Andre told Reuters news service in an emotional interview on Wednesday that the Israeli attack had targeted them systematically, car by car.
They were targeting us in a conflicting zone, in an area controlled by IDF. Them knowing that was our teams moving on that route with two armor, with three cars. And then they hit the third one, and then we saw the consequences of that continuous targeting attack. Seven people dead, but there are seven on top of a list of more than another 190 humanitarian workers that they've been killed over the last 6 months.
Israel says it was an accident and that its forces don't target aid workers.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Thousands of people took to the streets in Turkey's southeastern city of Van on Wednesday to celebrate an election board decision restoring pro-Kurdish mayor-elect Abdullah Zeyden to his post. Turkish authorities prevented him from taking office at first in a last-minute court ruling, saying instead that the candidate from President Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, who came in second, would get the seat.
WhatsApp was down for tens of thousands of users on Wednesday, according to outage tracking website downdetector.com. Last month, hundreds of thousands of users of Meta's Facebook and Instagram globally were impacted for more than 2 hours following an outage that was caused by a technical issue.
Laid-off workers and union members in Argentina staged a symbolic takeover of the Ministry of Labor building on Wednesday to protest President Javier Milei's government reductions that have cost 15,000 jobs in public institutions. Unions are talking about calling for a national strike to demand a rollback of Milei's planned cuts.
Illegal immigration is the top issue for many voters in this year's U.S. presidential election. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at how candidates Donald Trump and Joe Biden differ on the issue.
In this week's Wisconsin primary, illegal immigration was a leading issue for many voters, including contractor Scott Lindeman.
Immigration, inflation, right to life. I would say those are the big three for me.
Lindeman voted for Republican Donald Trump before and says he will again. Trump told a Wisconsin rally that he's preparing the largest deportation in American history to rid the country of what he considers dangerous people.
They're sending prisoners, murderers, drug dealers, mental patients, terrorists. The worst of every country is coming into our country now. They're coming from the Congo, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, all over the world. They're coming there. Country-changing, country-threatening, and their country-wrecking. They're destroying our country.
A recent Harvard Caps Harris poll indicates immigration is the top issue for U.S. voters, with more than a third of respondents placing it above the economy, crime, and health care. President Joe Biden says immigrants contribute to the U.S. economy and are not the dangerous animals his opponent calls them.
On my first day in office as president, I introduced a comprehensive plan to fix our immigration system. Secure our border, provide a pathway for citizens, for dreamers and their families, farm workers, essential workers who helped us through the pandemic and are part of the fabric of our community. Because unlike Donald Trump, I know who we are as Americans.
Trump supporters recall his 2016 pledge to build a wall at the Mexican border. If reelected, he says he'll finish the job.
With your vote, I will seal the border. I will stop the invasion. I will end the carnage, bloodshed, and killing. And we will crush the human traffickers.
A U.S. appeals court last week stopped Texas from implementing a law that would criminalize unauthorized entry into the state and allow Texas judges to order the deportation of those arrested. Biden told U.S. mayors that there's a bipartisan plan in Congress to improve border security with more immigration judges and asylum officers, as well as high-tech drug detection.
This bill would save lives, bring order to the border. It has the funds that many of our cities badly need as well. It would also give me, as president, new emergency authority, or any other president, temporarily shut down the border when a number of immigrants is overwhelming and to regain control of the border.
House Republicans objected to the bipartisan border bill, based in part on objections voiced by Trump. The Senate also failed to advance the legislation. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Uganda's constitutional court has declined to annul or grant a permanent injunction against the enforcement of the country's anti-gay law. In their ruling Wednesday, the judges said the law does infringe on some fundamental human rights and addressed those matters. Lawyers representing members of Uganda's LGBTQ plus community described the ruling as retrogressive. Halima Atumani reports from the Ugandan capital.
In their ruling Wednesday, the Constitutional Court judges had noted that the law was meant to protect children, especially in cases where recruitment and targeting of children has been reported. However, the judges did rule that the law does infringe on some rights, specifically parts of the law that would effectively deny members of the LGBT community access to health services such as anti-HIV treatment.
We find that Section 3.2c violates their right.
The ruling nullified those sections of the Act. Lawyer Nicholas Opio described the whole ruling as an inherently faulty judgment of the court.
That it is legal to exclude the LGBTI community from participating in the affairs of their country. What is to say you have access to health when your very existence is being challenged and being declared unconstitutional? I think that it's a failed attempt at a balancing act.
Eric Ndaula, an LGBT activist, told VOA that the community was let down by the court.
They did not have facts, but rather they were looking at perceptions. They were looking at what the media was saying rather than what the actual facts were. If you're talking about recruitment, but you do not have any evidence of recruitment, except statements from an individual that have not been substantiated, it is a sad day.
The petitioners can appeal the matter to Uganda's Supreme Court. The Anti-Homosexuality Act, which took effect last May, says engaging in acts of homosexuality is punishable with life imprisonment. The law also imposes the death penalty for what it calls aggravated homosexuality, including sexual relations involving people infected with HIV, as well as sex with people categorized as vulnerable, including minors and the elderly. The law has been denounced by gay activists and many foreign governments, including the Biden administration, as a violation of human rights. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope, along with Scott Walterman. NATO foreign ministers met on Wednesday to discuss how to put military support for Ukraine on a long-term footing, including a proposal for a $107 billion five-year fund and a plan seen as a way to Trump-proof aid for Kyiv. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan has more.
NATO foreign ministers met on Wednesday to discuss a proposal for a 100 billion euro five-year fund. It is a plan seen as a way to Trump-proof aid for Ukraine. The proposals would give the Western alliance a more direct role in coordinating the supply of arms, ammunition and equipment to Kyiv as it fights Russia's invasion, diplomats say. Speaking before the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the proposal aims to send the message to Russia that it cannot win the war.
What is obvious is that we need new and more money for Ukraine, and we need it over many years. And the whole idea of now discussing frameworks, commitments, an institutionalized framework for the support is to ensure more predictability and more confidence in that the money will come every month, every year for the long haul.
He declined to confirm levels of funding and said the aim was for a decision to be taken at the July Washington summit. Under the plans, NATO would take over some coordination work from a US-led ad hoc coalition known as the Ramstein Group, a move designed in part to guard against any cut in US support if Donald Trump returns to the White House, diplomats said. NATO has focused on non-lethal aid for Ukraine out of fears that a more direct role would trigger an escalation of tensions with Russia. Diplomats said there was a growing view it was time for the group to put military aid to Ukraine on a more sustainable footing. But they said it was unclear whether the 1 billion euro figure, that's over $107 billion, would be accepted or how it would be financed. Any decision by the group requires consensus of its 32 members. Arriving at the talks, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock described the proposal as right and important, saying that aid for Ukraine should be dispersed via reliable long-term structures. But in a sign that a decision may not be easy, Hungary signalled scepticism about at least some elements of Stoltenberg's proposal. Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó firmly stated Hungary will not back any NATO proposals that might draw the alliance closer to war or shift it from a defensive to an offensive coalition, government spokesman Zoltán Kovács said on X.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
Today, April 4th, NATO turns 75 years old. Here is U.S. President Harry Truman 75 years ago talking about the treaty at its start.
This treaty is a simple document. The nations which sign it agree to abide by the peaceful principles of the United Nations, to maintain friendly relations and economic cooperation with one another, to consult together whenever the territory or independence of any of them is threatened, and to come to the aid of any one of them who may be attacked. If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace.
It was a different world 75 years ago. The world was just coming out of World War II, a war which had devastated much of Europe.
This was the great fire in the city of London, almost to be compared with the fire of London in 1666. Pictures that look like hell on earth. The world will see these pictures of a raid that was not aimed at military objectives, only at the things that men and women have loved for centuries. The churches built by Christopher Wren after the fire of London. The famous buildings of the Civic Company, the Guildhall.
The history of Europe has been one of, perpetual conflict. Up until the realization of NATO 75 years ago in 1949, which has maintained a really durable peace within the Euro-Atlantic zone. So that, to me, I think more so than anything else, is the historic nature of the accomplishment.
That's Robert Benson, senior policy analyst for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress. The most basic premise of NATO is that if any member is attacked, all the members will come to their defense. It's only been enacted once in the past 75 years. That's when the United States was attacked on September 11th, and all the other NATO nations provided assistance in the war that followed. And finally, here's a question for you. What time is it on the moon? The White House has directed NASA to establish a unified standard of time for the moon and other celestial bodies, as the United States aims to set international norms in space amid a growing lunar race among nations and private companies. But what does it mean? Reuters correspondent Emma Jahil explains.
It's 5:24 p.m. Central Time, but know that there is some give and take.
It comes as no surprise that moon time differs from Earth time. As the U.S. aims to set international norms amid a growing lunar race, the White House has given NASA a directive to establish a unified time standard for the moon. NASA must work with other parts of the U.S. government to set Coordinated Lunar Time, or LTC, by the end of 2026. That's according to a memo seen by Reuters from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, or OSTP. Here's what's at play. The differing gravitational force and potentially other factors on the moon change how time unfolds relative to how it is perceived on Earth. The OSTP memo says that for a person on the moon, an Earth-based clock would appear to lose about 58.7 microseconds per Earth day. Having a standard time would provide a timekeeping benchmark for lunar spacecraft and satellites that require extreme precision. Under its Artemis program, NASA is planning more astronaut missions to the moon in coming years. It aims to establish a scientific lunar base that could help set the stage for future missions to Mars. Dozens of companies, spacecraft, and countries are involved in the effort. Other countries also have their own lunar ambitions. China has said it aims to put its first astronauts on the moon by 2030, while India last year became the first country to land a spacecraft near the unexplored lunar South Pole. An OSTP official said that without a unified lunar time standard, it would be challenging to ensure data integrity and synchronized communications between Earth, lunar satellites, bases, and astronauts. Time discrepancies could also lead to errors in mapping and locating positions on or orbiting the moon, the official said. On Earth, most clocks and time zones are based on Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC. This internationally recognized standard relies on a vast global network of atomic clocks placed around the world. They measure changes in the state of atoms and generate an average that ultimately makes up a precise time. The deployment of atomic clocks on the lunar surface may be needed, according to the OSTP official. The OSTP memo says that implementing LTC will require international agreements through existing standards bodies and among the 36 nations that have signed a pact called the Artemis Accords, which involve how countries act in space and on the moon. China and Russia, the two main U.S. rivals in space, have not signed the accords.
Reuters correspondent Emma Jahil.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope, along with Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to pushing back vigorously on authoritarian governments' increasing use of technology to abuse human rights and undermine democracy, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken during the Summit for Democracy in Seoul, South Korea.
That starts with shoring up our resilience against efforts by autocratic governments to sow distrust in democracy, to weaken our institutions, to reach across borders, to target people in our countries. A key part of that is countering the disinformation and misinformation that authoritarian governments spread to polarize our societies.
The U.S. is working to help people living under repressive regimes like Iran get access to digital tools, including the uncensored internet, said Secretary Blinken.
Last September, when the killing of Mahsa Amini by Iran's security forces sparked months of massive protests, the regime cracked down viciously, killing hundreds of people, imprisoning tens of thousands more, and routinely shutting down the internet. In response, we teamed up with companies and civil society groups to help provide the Iranian people with ongoing access to the internet and other vital communications tools so that they could continue to communicate with one another and with the outside world and shine a spotlight on the regime's abuses.
It's not just Iran where the private sector and civil society are working with democratic governments to push back against digital authoritarianism. Since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2023, businesses and citizens from the United States and other democracies have been on the front lines helping Ukraine defend its independence, explained Secretary Blinken.
These volunteers have helped maintain connectivity for Ukrainian government institutions and citizens despite the relentless attacks, providing the Ukrainian government with free access to a secure cloud to store sensitive national databases, helping to counter Moscow's disinformation campaigns on social media.
Ultimately, we feel optimistic about democracy's ability to deliver in a period where technology is once again reorganizing the life of the world, said Secretary Blinken. For all of the challenges that these disruptive technologies present, no system of government is better equipped to drive the forces that they represent in improving our people's lives than democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.